It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. The east coast of Russia is far out of mind for Alaskans most of the time, but it's not that far away physically, and the geography, culture, and history of the region are deeply intertwined with ours. You can even go there for an adventure if you're ready for something completely new. The Russian Far East was walled off from Alaska by the Cold War for decades, but in the 1990s that ice curtain fell, and some lucky Alaskans had amazing adventures on the far side of the Bering Sea. We'll hear some of those stories on today's show, with a traveler who spent time in Kamchatka, and another who boated and dogmushed in Chukotka. And although many of those opportunities closed years ago, we'll also get into how you can arrange a trip today. Stay with us for the Russian Far East on Outdoor Explorer. My first guest today is Erica Monahan Downs, and she is a historian, an author of learned books about Russia, Siberia. Her recent book is The Merchants of Siberia, Trade in the Early Modern Eurasia, which sounds very brainy for Outdoor Explorer. We're usually talking about dudes out in the snow and like doing adventures. But in fact, Erica has done some really cool stuff in the Russian Far East, which is our topic today, and in Kamchatka and places that most people can really only dream about or think of as just being places on the map. So thanks for being here, Erica.
Thanks for having me, Charles.
So these adventures we're going to talk about were quite a while ago. So when did you go to Kamchatka?
I went to Kamchatka in 1999. So it's a pretty long time ago now.
Yeah. So what, and you were climbing and adventuring and all that. And maybe we'll start by just orienting people where Kamchatka is.
Sure. So Kamchatka is, so many people have only heard of it that they've played the game Risk. And it's this massive, Risk. And it's this massive peninsula on the northeast corner of the Eurasia. And it is... And so it's far, far away. It's actually closer to Alaska than it is
far away from everything.
Moscow. It's far away from everything, and it's pretty hard to get to. And I had been living in Russia for the past couple years, to back up a little bit and how I got to Kamchatka. And I'd been working in this transport company in this, to be frank, hellish job, you know, long days trying to do logistics and get things from A to B while all my kind of... age mates in the States are working on the tech boom. I'm working in this, you know, trying to move things from A to B. And I did that for 2 years in the city of Moscow, which is a concrete jungle. And I really, really missed nature. I just wanted to kind of breathe some fresh air. And so
get me out of here.
Exactly. And so I had agreed to work at this job for two years, but I gave my notice. And then I wanted to go see some of the mountains of the former Soviet Union. And it's kind of a long story of all the places I got to, and I could elaborate more. But
But we're going to Kamchatka now. Sure. So stay on that track.
So yeah. I get to go to Kamchatka, and it is in terms of, you know, this being this exotic place. You know, a lot of American children, you know, where would you like to go? Disney World, Disneyland. It seemed to me that in Russia, you know, that your average adult, that going to Kamchatka was some sort of an exotic dream, a kind of dreamland, an exotic place to go to. And so I was thrilled.
Even beyond going to Alaska for Americans. I mean, they think we're exotic, but Kamchatka is like so far out there, yeah.
Yes, that sort of thing. And it does, I mean, the nature turns out to be so much like Alaska.
Okay, so you went all the way around to come back to where you started.
Sort of, although at that time I had never been to Alaska.
Oh, okay.
So it was only subsequently that I moved here. So I saw Kamchatka before I got to see Alaska.
So I understand it's one of the most volcanically active places on Earth. If you think of Yellowstone with all the geysers and fumaroles and all that stuff, Kamchatka is sort of that. And more, right?
Yes, and that is one of the absolute amazing things about it. And so from the ground level, you don't appreciate as the amazing topography of Kamchatka as much as you do if you fly over it or look at a map. And if you look at a topographical map of Kamchatka, you just see 20-plus mountains that are so conical. They're volcanoes. And my understanding is it has the most, the highest concentration of active volcanoes in the world.
Wow.
And there was this place that I was able to go to it in 1999, the Valley of Geysers, the Linden Geyserhof. It since is much changed because of a massive landslide in 2007 that changed it. At the time, they told us there that it was the highest concentration of surface active geysers in the world. But according to Wikipedia, it's actually the second highest concentration in Yellowstone Lake.
We can't argue with Wikipedia.
Yes, but it is really something to see. The earth kind of gurgles and spews and steams. You feel like it's otherworldly. So getting there was amazing. And when I went to the Valley of Geysers, we went in a helicopter ride, and you fly over these conical volcanoes, and you see these crater lakes of just absolutely surreal colors. I mean, bright coral oranges and turquoises, and just colors that usually don't exist in nature.
Wow,
just like that.
Wow, and nobody's there. Is that like overrun with people?
It is pretty. It is pretty remote.
Uh huh. So, is there? Tell me about the. Are there towns and native or indigenous people there, or is it just like unpopulated?
Oh sure. Well, you know what? Of all my travels, and this is just my personal impressions, that the most remote place I've ever been is in the Altai Mountains in Siberia, where, I've stood atop, maybe just 7,000 foot mountain or so at night and look 360 degrees and not be able to see any trace of human lighting.
Wow.
Or roads cut or anything like that. And I never got to any place that I had that sense of being that remote in Kamchatka. My travels were confined to the bottom half of the peninsula. I didn't go north of Mount Kluchevsky, which is sort of halfway up the peninsula. Kluchevsky, named, by the way, after one of the greatest Russian historians.
There you go. So that must be very good help.
Yes. I didn't get to climb it. It's 15,500 feet. We did some smaller volcanoes around there, one of which did involve roping up at the very top of this snowy mountain, only to see a mosquito flying on top of the snow up there. Those hardy Kamchatkan mosquitoes. Along the way, there are a fair amount of villages, small villages. The biggest city is Petropavlovsk. But even Petropavlovsk, to talk a little bit about my city, was in some ways depressing when I was there in 1999. I mean, an apple is very expensive. Things are, like we have in Alaska, things are really expensive. There isn't a lot of industry going on there. There's the naval base. If I were to get into the whole story of how I got there, I ended up staying a few more days than I intended in the city of Petropavlovsk. And do you want me to kind of tell you how I get there?
Sure, sure.
Okay, so here I am in Moscow working at this horrible job that is just killing my soul in this concrete jungle. I want to get to mountains, but I'm dutiful. I want to keep my word. And so when my 2 years is up, I want to go see mountains. I'm going to do this. And I start trying to put together this trip. And it isn't, and I'd been there for 2 years. I'd been doing the language. So I want to kind of get there on my own. I'm not kind of going through any tour agency. And my job had been logistics, so I should know logistics. Well, it turns out to be not that easy to do all this. But,
right.
And so I put together this trip where I spent a month in the Altai Mountains, and I went and I climbed Elbrus in the Caucasus, and I went into the Pamir Alais, and I also got to go to Kamchatka. And the way that I got to go to Kamchatka was this. It was my job as a transport specialist to kind of talk to the wives, pretty much the wives of corporate men and diplomats that are there, and women were diplomats too, but most of the oil people were men, and convince them that our agency should move their personal goods when ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips and BP is going to move them in and out of Russia. And so it was my job to be the girl next door and assure them that we had a sophisticated global logistics network, and then go back to our office where we go out the back door and kind of wave down some crummy Russian truck and tell them to move some things across town. There was that sort of disconnect that goes with working in the Russian economy.
Sorry.
But at any rate, through all this work, I meet the Mrs. Carter, a wonderful woman who is the wife of the head of the World Bank, Michael Carter, in Moscow at the time. And her son, she had a son about my age, who had done the English voiceover for a film about environmental issues in Kamchatka for Greenpeace. If you're in the 90s, you know, perestroika had happened. Russia is waking up to democratic process, and all these social causes are rising to the fore and are important to people. And in Kamchatka, environmental issues is huge, and there's a big environmental movement. Sadly,
isn't that great?
Yes, it was great. It was great in those sort of chaotic 90s, and sadly, much of that has been quelched now, and you don't kind of see that same grassroots activism.
And I want to get into that. We're going to get people very excited about this, and then squelch their dreams towards the end of the interview. But go on. Yeah. So you finally got that. Yeah.
So Stephen Carter had done the English voiceover, and as so much was the case in Russia at the time, the people making the documentary film said, "Well, we can't pay you, but we'll give you a free vacation in Kamchatka, and you can bring people." And so Mrs. Carter actually volunteered me to join her son's trip.
Sweet.
Yeah, how lucky for me, poor Stephen. But I met him, and he was gracious enough to say, "Yeah, come along, join us." And so at the time, though, I was lining up this trip to the Altai, planning to spend a little over a month there. I thought I wouldn't be able to go. And so I sort of said, that would be so great, but I think I can't do it. And we said bye. And then when I was in the Altai, it had been such a rainy year in 1999 that we couldn't cross all this territory and then cross this bigger river. So it's like a lot of marsh and then this really rushing river that the two people I was with were pretty sure we wouldn't be able to cross. So we came back a little over a week early, and I thought, gosh, maybe
could still do Kamchatka.
I could still catch up with them in Kamchatka. So I take this 9-hour bus ride to Novosibirsk, and I don't have the phone number I need to connect with the people in Kamchatka because it hadn't seemed important. I didn't think I could do it at the time. So I fly 5 time zones from Novosibirsk back to Moscow, and I go and I can't find their phone number still. So
just to get the phone number.
Yes, just to get the phone number. And so I can't find the phone number even in my apartment in Moscow. And so I go to their house and it's locked down. They're on vacation. The family has left. And but the dezhurnaya, and in the Soviet Union, part of the maybe full employment scheme, every kind of entranceway to a building or business has a woman that stands there and watches the door and, you know, opens the windows and shuts the windows and scolds people who track in their mud, etc. Uh-huh. And the dezhurnaya said, "Oh, they're on vacation. They can't help you." But she had the phone number. So this dezhurnaya gives me the phone number, even though the family's on vacation. I call up the director of this film in Kamchatka, and they're already out on a trek in southern Kamchatka. But he says, "Okay, come along, and I'll meet you." And so I then fly from Moscow, 9 time zones east,
to
Petropavlovsk. The total cost of those 2 flights from Novosibirsk to Moscow, and then from Moscow to Petropavlovsk, because I didn't have the phone number, was a total cost of $220 at the time.
So I'm sure times have changed now.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And so I land in Petropavlovsk, and the other people I'm going to meet up with, they're out on a trek. They're going to come back and regroup in Petropavlovsk in a few days and go out again. So this director puts me up with this volcanologist who lives there in Petropavlovsk. And so he's a man that studies, very educated, the Institute of Volcanology. I mean, if you want to study volcanoes, Kamchatka is the place to do it.
Right.
So he's kind of living his dream, but he's living his dream to kind of get to the decrepit infrastructure in a 6-flight walk-up, a small apartment. I spent 4 nights in his apartment, sleeping in a sleeping bag on his floor. And for 2 of those nights, there was no electricity. It'd been turned off.
Yeah.
And for 2 of those 24-hour periods, there was no water.
Wow.
And the city, they don't tell you when the electricity is going to be turned off at that point, but they would tell you when they weren't going to turn on the water. So he would, fill up his bathtub entirely, and then he'd scoop it out to brush his teeth, cook his food, wash his face, flush the toilet. And I mean, this is how this.
And this is why people were pretty unhappy in those days. Yeah, yeah. We're talking with Erica Monahan Downs on Outdoor Explorer. My name is Charles Wolforth. She's a historian, a professional historian. She's written a book which does not exactly relate to what we're talking about, but I want to mention it. It's called The Merchants of Siberia. And she's actually been to Kamchatka, as you're hearing. Quite a while ago, some 18 years ago, but what an interesting adventure and what a neat piece of the world globe to kind of fill in your imagination of what it looks like and what goes on there, what kinds of adventures can be had there. might be virtually impossible to get there now. We're going to talk about that more later in the show, but we can still dream. And Erica is definitely an explorer. So I want to, there's a lot of history related to Kamchatka. And as we think of Vitus Bering, who was the original explorer of Alaska, and after whom the Bering Sea and the Bering Strait are named, his story, I think, is probably my favorite story of historical effort and futility. That he you know, did this two incredible expeditions. You got to fly the nine time zones. He had to walk, right?
And build the roads.
And then he had, as I understand, he had to build ships across the sea of, what is the sea called?
Sea of Okhotsk.
Okhotsk. Then he gets off in Kamchatka. Then he crosses Kamchatka. And then he has to build more ships to get to Alaska. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you were there, could you kind of imagine the incredible difficulty of that?
Oh, absolutely. And in some ways, it was that inspiration, I think, that kind of led me to want to study the history of explorers. I mean, my specialty became kind of the history of the settlement of Siberia. And when maybe one of the kernels to that, you know, life path I've since followed is that while I was waiting for the other group to come back so we could go out trekking in Kamchatka, Misha, in his apartment, he had a copy of this book called Tent Life in Siberia by George Kennan. And George Kennan was, many Americans hear George Kennan and the long telegram.
He's kind of invented our concept of the Cold War, of containment of the Soviet Union.
Exactly. Yeah. But this George Kennan was his cousin twice removed, who lived earlier than him. He died in 1924. The George Kennan of the long telegram died in 2005. And this George Kennan, as a young guy, gets hired by this company that is trying to lay a cable, a telegraph cable. They tried to do it across the Atlantic, failed in the first major attempt. They're going to do it across the Pacific. And so they hire an exploratory team that George Kennan, this 20-year-old, gets this job, takes a boat from San Francisco to Kamchatka.
I mean, imagine the exploration and the I mean, you're just terra incognita.
Yes, absolutely. And then he spends 2 years exploring the peninsula of Kamchatka and going west to try and find a route. He becomes fascinated with Russia, returns on two subsequent trips, does exploring in the Caucasus, writes about the exile system. But this book, Tent Life in Kamchatka, in any ways, fired my imagination. This volcanologist, Misha, what he had done, he read it and he retraced one winter his on a just single solo ski.
And so that helped set you out on your career.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I didn't know it at the time, but it really fired my imagination. And then I looked farther back, and it was Bering on his second expedition, which became the second Kamchatka expedition, and which is part of this 1733 to 1743 massive expedition. And my heart, I have a soft place in my heart for poor Vitus Bering, because
the whole story is so tragic and so futile, and there's so much effort.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, you know, so he had, Bering, to like recap, had gone on his first expedition, and they feel pretty confident that Europe and Asia aren't connected. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that locally, they could have some locals tell them that it wasn't connected. In some ways, the study of Russian history is rediscovering knowledge that got lost a little bit.
Right.
But they get back to St. Petersburg, and he says, well, we're pretty sure they're not connected. And there were enemies at court or whatnot, and they said, oh, he's horrible, and they tried to do a hatchet job on him. And Peter the Great kind of is willing to protect him. And before Peter dies in 17, he dies in 1725. Before he dies, he says, all right, do another expedition and you've got to do it. And he's like, all right, I'll go back. And then on this expedition, it succumbs.
10,000 people or something.
Yeah, talk about mission creep.
Oh my God.
They bring on these prima donna French. They're going to have entomologists count the bugs and biologists count the flora. And there's going to be an eclipse out there. And
one of my favorite parts about reading about this is they show up in there are these places. Oh, we'll stop in this town on the way, right? Mm-hmm. And they're dragging all this stuff. There's no iron in the Russian Far East. So they actually have to bring iron to make nails so they can build ships and anchors. Yeah. So they're dragging all this stuff across Russia. And they say, okay, we're going to go to this town. And they pull in, and it's like a little native village of a few huts. And he's got all these scientists, and they're saying, where are our quarters? You know, where's our... crazy.
I know. And it... And the person who actually wrote, Stepan Krishaninikov, is this one of the first Russians that gets admitted to kind of study in the Academy of Sciences. When it's founded after in 1725, it's all foreigners and Germans that come. And one of the head Germans, G.F. Mueller, is the head of the expedition. He doesn't want to go that far east. He spends the whole time kind of writing, complaining about his hemorrhoids and asking to come back to the capital. And so he gets this intern, Krasheninnikov, and he sends him to Kamchatka. And so one of the first travel accounts we have, explorations through Kamchatka, is Krasheninnikov going through, and he kind of writes ethnographies, and he's trying to do science, and so kind of this 1730s account is one of the first. I actually assigned part of it to my students alongside George Kennan's 1860s account of this American in his 20s traveling through Kamchatka, and I think, you know, they're both fascinating reads.
And then you've got your 1999 account, and then your personal.
Yes.
So tell me, what's it like traveling there? Because I've heard of people talking about in that period, and I don't know what it's like now, that it's very different. I mean, there's a lot of helicopters used and like big vehicles that people ride on, and it's not at all like it is here to travel sort of in the backcountry. True?
Yeah. Well, so my backcountry experience consists of hiking along trails, and in contrast to the Altai, actually, where there were no trails and you are kind of bushwhacking through alders, like big leg lifts every step in Kamchatka. And here, again, I'm being this, you know, this film producer knows people that knows where the trails are. And they sort of take us on a 8-day trek through places. And so there's trails, there's huge nature, there's kind of a version of Devil's Club that you don't want to touch at all, much like in Alaska, and beautiful scenes. But we did have, and we just hiked in, whereas in the Altai, kind of no trails, but we'd come along to little huts, and you'd go in, and there'd actually be baggies of gudechka and dry grain for you to boil up that you don't know how long they've been there, because it's a pretty remote place. In Kamchatka, we just sort of camped at little clearings. When we did it, actually, this was the first time I had ever, for 3 days straight, it rained. And so it was hiking in the rain, setting up your tent, cramming into it, falling asleep with the sound of pitter-patter, pitter-patter. We had 4 people crammed into a 2-person tent.
Fun.
I still have that tent. My husband doesn't believe it.
I'm sure they were really glad that you showed up.
Yeah. It was my tent, for what it's worth. Other is they had a tarp. But no, I know. They were so gentle with me. So we would fall asleep to the pitter-patter. And you know when you're like pressing against the tent, it makes everything even wetter. And there isn't room in the tent, so everything's outside. And we would get up in the morning and you would put back on, you know, wet socks, wet boots, roll up a wet tent. And truly did this for 3 days straight, the tent just getting heavier and heavier and heavier. Yeah. And then on the fourth day, after that rain, we arrived to these hot springs. I'd actually never been to hot springs before, and it's always a bit of a treat being out there in nature, coming across this naturally hot pool. But, oh, believe me, after being just wet, wet, wet for days straight, to sit in those warm hot springs was pure joy.
And these are they wild, sort of undeveloped hot springs? Are there baths there, or what?
They were a little bit developed. The place we got to, there was a hut, and there were very tastefully done kind of wooden cedar benches along the side.
Wow.
And so, I've been to some different ones in Siberia that you might say weren't tastefully done, where they just sort of around the hot spring slabbed down concrete, and it, you know, didn't have a very aesthetic. It wasn't very aesthetically satisfying. This hot springs, I mean, it is a bit of a tourist place, but very kind of just tasteful and out of the way and not people there anyway, and it was beautiful.
And you really were ready for a warm bath.
Oh, it was pure joy.
Erica Monahan Downs is with me, who's obviously a wonderful storyteller. I'm so glad you could be here. She's a historian and author of the book The Merchants of Siberia: Trade in Early Modern Eurasia. The show is Outdoor Explorer. And I'm Charles Wolforth. You said it's like Alaska, but of course Alaska is a lot of different places. Would you say it's more like the Big Trees of Southeast Alaska? Is it more like South Central? Is it more like the Arctic? What orient us as sort of biologically to what it's like in Kamchatka?
Pretending that I'm an expert on all of Alaska, and I'm not. I'm more through pictures, but not trees and forests, but not as big and mossy as, say, in the Tongass South wilderness, but more and not tundra taiga, yet either kind of deciduous forest intermixed with a lot of evergreens.
Okay.
Was the kind of in the bottom half of Kamchatka that we're moving through.
And you said big nature, which I love that phrase. But when you say that, what do you mean?
You know what? I'm thinking of big leaves. Oh. In some ways, I mean, I have these recollections of really big leaves and tall grass and tall plants. Not so overtaken by the tree size in terms of, you know, the redwoods of the Pacific or the kind of in the Tongass wilderness. But quite big trees, but just really big bushes and green everywhere. I mean, it's just the area I was through, it was an explosion of green.
Yeah. And a lot of up and down. It's all mountainous, I take it.
Yeah. And I mean, we were actually our big trek. We kind of hiked Avanchiskaya and another volcano. But these are kind of plopped there. Much of the terrain we moved through on this trek that I did with them was more flat, not the big passes and not as much up and down as I'd done in the Altai or in the Pamir Alais or the Caucasus. So kind of but you could do it differently, of course. You know, you could go and get that up and down in terrain, and we happened to kind of take like flattish territory among mountains more than doing a lot of vertical ourselves.
Yeah.
I think they thought, you know, soft Westerners, they wouldn't take it, because there was, I do remember this one completely demoralizing moment for the 320 something guys in our group. The people that took us hiking was this man, Valery Nikolaevich, and his two sons. And then it was, you know, Stephen Carter, who had done the voiceover, and his brother and a friend, and then me. So we're seven people. And there was this moment where we're crossing this big rushing stream. And it looks kind of rough. And quite how are we going to get across it? And we're all, you know, going up and down, trying to figure it out. Valery Nikolaevich says, "We're going to cross here. It's my job to keep you safe. I'm going to carry you across." Valery Nikolaevich is kind of a spindly, skinny man, probably in his 70s.
Oh, my God.
So these 20-something guys are, "Oh, no, I am going to carry you across." And so for me, it was a little bit demoralizing, but I'm a girl, I can get away with it. He carries me across, he carries his two sons across, and he carries these three strapping 20-something Westerners across this rushing spot of brook. And they were, I mean, I think it was supposed to be one of those, like, what happens in Kamchatka stays in Kamchatka moments. And now here I am saying it on the radio. But Valery Nikolaevich was not to be dissuaded. And he's this old, strong man who doesn't even have socks, by the way. He has these things Russians call partyanka, he's wearing kind of, you know, galoshes with not socks, but these strips of fabric that you just wrap around your feet. And it's an art form, by the way. And it's way versatile, because if in the event that some part of it gets sweaty or damp, you can refold it to have the dry parts where you need them and not get blisters. And so I really, what seemed so kind of primitive and poor you, when I, at a different point, I kind of came around and I went on a 3-day overnight at one point in with these partyanki and galoshes, and they worked great.
Well, I would love to talk much more, but I'm afraid we're out of time already. It just went by so quickly.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you,
Erica. Letting me go on.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. Erica Monahan Downs. We're going to talk a little bit about how you can actually get to the Russian Far East and what kinds of things you can do as a visitor. And then later on, we're going to hear about mushing farther north in Chukotka and that part of the Russian Far East that's across from the Seward Peninsula in Alaska. So stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer as we continue talking about the Russian Far East and the adventures there. It's not exactly Alaska, but it's pretty close. And in some ways the same, and in some ways different, as we've been hearing. And in the last section, we're going to hear a bit about mushing in Chukotka and some incredible adventures there. But I wanted to make sure we talked about what's happening now and the opportunities to get to Russia and what you can actually do. And for that, I've got Mark Dudley with me. He's in Seattle. He's with Interpacific Aviation and Marketing. And Mark went over beginning in the 90s and explored and did some adventuring. And now he's with a company that's actually flying from Anchorage over to Russia. Thanks for being with us, Mark.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you were saying that you were doing some interesting stuff there pretty early on, and I guess you got a taste for the Russian Far East. How did you first get there?
Well, I perhaps first got a taste for the Russian Far East just talking to Russian friends on board the Soviet vessels I was working on in the 1980s in a joint Soviet-American fishing venture working in American waters. But soon I got the opportunity to work with REI Adventures planning trips in the Russian Far East. I did an exploratory trip in Primorye, which is near Vladivostok, kind of across the Sea of Japan from Japan, in what's considered to be, you know, some of the last remaining Siberian tiger habitat. So that was a fantastic rafting trip over there. And then I also was one of the first Americans to explore Kamchatka. There's, you know, I've been going back and forth to Kamchatka ever since. It's a fantastic place to visit, and it's sort of like Eurasia's Alaska, but it has a little bit of its own personality.
It's so exotic, right? I mean, it's not, like, it's not even in our scope of reference, and then you look at the map and say, well, okay, it's not that far away, and it's got to be pretty wild. And I mean, is that the part of the attraction, just that it's so wild and new, and it sounds like really beautiful?
Well, it is very beautiful, and one reason why it's exciting to visit is because it has been, in fact, isolated for so long. They have an area there known as Geyser Valley, for example, and Russians will traditionally explore, you know, by following fish upstream. Well, there was a stream with no fish in it, so nobody ever thought to go up it. But then a geologist, a woman, and I forget the exact date, and I forget her name, it was in the 1940s, I think, followed this stream up anyway and discovered this isolated valley that's sort of like a lot like Yellowstone, except it's in a small, compact, steep-sided valley. So that's sort of one of the premier attractions of Kamchatka is Geyser Valley. You know, and that's just, you know, one of many things. You know, the area's got great bear viewing. The fishing is phenomenal. I have Alaskans telling me that it's what Alaska was like 50 years ago. And, you know, this is in part because it's been so isolated, not just by the distances, but by politics for much of the Soviet period, for example.
What kind of fishing are they doing in Kamchatka?
Not even Russians could go there.
What kind of fishing do they do? Is it salmon fishing, or what kind of sport fishing do they do?
Kamchatka is where salmon, and I'm not an expert, but the salmon specialists tell me that this is where they believe salmon evolved. It's got a lot of salmon species, but most of the people who fly over on our flights on Yakutia Airlines aircraft are heading over to do rainbow trout fly fishing.
Uh-huh. And I bet it's...
they'll catch some real monsters.
I bet they do. So tell us about your services. What do you do, and what kind of clients do you have?
We've been operating the service for 6 years. This year, the service will operate on Mondays from July 17th to September 4th, so once a week. We fly from Anchorage on Mondays, and the flight goes through Kamchatka and on to Yakutsk. It's just a 4.5-hour flight over to Kamchatka. A good share of our clients, as I mentioned, are fly fishermen. But in addition, we get a lot of Russian families flying back and forth, or Americans of Russian heritage flying back and forth. And we're getting a growing number of adventure travelers. People are going over there to go trekking, hiking, volcano climbing, rafting. We get birders going over. Occasionally we'll get a half a plane load full of people joining cruise ships. There's more and more cruise ships calling in Russian Far East ports where you can hop on board and take it up into the Arctic, go visit Wrangel Island, see some polar bears, come back down.
Very interesting. So do you help people figure out what they would do for an adventure travel trip? Because I would think there'd be a lot of logistics involved. Or are there resources you can point them to?
Well, on our website, we have a great starting point. We pretty much just sell tickets, but we have really good relationships with a lot of vendors. We work closely with the Russian consulate in Seattle, so we have up-to-date information about how to get Russian visas. So it's a good resource, airrussia.us. We can, if you're interested in this particular type of, most trips in Kamchatka, I would say, are sort of custom designed. You'll contact an outfitter, kind of tell them what you're interested. They'll get back to you, let you know the budget, what options are available. And then you just head on over and, one day you might visit Geyser Valley, for example. You need to take a helicopter there. Then you might take a, maybe a two-day road trip up to Ploski-Tolbachik volcano, which is a volcano that had a huge eruption a couple years ago, but it's still a fascinating place to explore. You might go on a boat cruise, hot springs, lots of hot springs around. So anyway, lots to do, but I would recommend finding a good outfitter, tour operator, who can get you your visa support letter and kind of let you know what the options are.
Yeah, sounds like there's quite a bit of paperwork to going to Russia. And I imagine, unless you want to travel very rough, you probably need to know a little bit about where to stay and that kind of thing.
Right. And, I mean, there are options. A few years ago we had a couple of Alaskan pack rafters go over, and all they wanted was to be dropped off at one point in the wilderness and be picked up at another point at another time. And so you can have something as bare bones as that. Or you could stay in a very nice lodge-style guest house at a very convenient point where you can head off on day trips, every day. Or there's also sort of the classic stay in a, Soviet-era hotel downtown. That's probably my least preferred option. The guest house are probably the number one way to go.
Yeah. So I can't imagine this is an inexpensive vacation. This is sort of a vacation for people who have already seen the rest of the world because it's a little bit exotic. But how much does it cost to get over there and to sort of set up a trip?
Airfares start at $1,150 if you're going for a three-week stay, a little bit more if your trip is shorter.
That's not bad.
Right. I mean, for a one-week stay, it's getting up closer to $1,800 or more per round trip. So you get a better deal if you're going for 2 or 3 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And then it's kind of hard to tell exactly what things are going to cost in Russia because of the exchange rates fluctuate quite a bit between the ruble and the dollar. But you're getting some better deals now because the ruble is suffering a bit.
Interesting.
Right. And the most expensive part of any trip to Kamchatka are helicopter excursions. They tend to cost like, $500 for an expedition up to Geyser Valley, which might seem a little steep, but, it's something I think you should just budget for because most of the other trips are much more economically priced. So you could let an outfitter know kind of that you want to do one or two helicopter trips, several day trips, and then they can get you a budget for that.
Pretty neat. All right. Well, you've certainly piqued my interest. Mark Dudley is with Interpacific Aviation and Marketing in Seattle. Thanks so much for being with us, Mark.
Happy to be here. Thanks for the call.
And stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. Well, for our final interview on today's show about the Russian Far East, I have a treat. We're going to go back in time to what the time we call the fall of the Ice Curtain, when suddenly Alaskans were able to go to the Russian Far East and make these connections or remake these connections that had existed before the Cold War and do some amazing adventures, which are now the source, the stuff of legend. And my guest right now is Sue Steinacker, who's in Nome. She was a musher, an outdoors person who was one of the early folks who went over to Chukotka, which is the extremely remote and really poverty-stricken and highly indigenous region that's right across the Bering Strait from the Seward Peninsula in Alaska. and had some amazing adventures there, mushing and boating, and I was really, really pleased to be able to get Sue on the show. Thanks for being with us, Sue.
Oh, thank you for your interest.
It was a short period when Russia opened up and then kind of closed again, and you were lucky enough to be really at the ground floor and I guess among the first to kind of cross the Bering Strait by boat as the ice curtain had fallen. Tell us a little bit about how that took place.
Well, for me, it began even earlier when I was working as a walrus harvest monitor on Little Diomede Island, and I fell in love with the island and the village and the people. And so in the preceding years, I had built a very close relationship with that village. And then when this ice curtain started to thaw, this was what people, adventurers, were some of the first that wanted to cross. And they want to cross in that narrow strait from mainland North America to mainland Eurasia across the Bering Strait. And so initially, there were three different kayak groups that all wanted to paddle across, and they decided they would all go together. One of them, Jim Noyes, is a paraplegic and is paddling a three-hole Baidara built by George Dyson. Jim wanted a support boat. He felt this was a safe thing to do, and they wanted a group of Diomeders in a walrus skin boat to be their support boat. So they got in touch with me, and I arranged, I found the crew and got everybody their passports and was included. And the Diomeders were very anxious to reconnect with relatives, and this was a way for them to finally get over there. So it wasn't the best crossing because the kayakers didn't take advantage of the wisdom of the Diomeders, and they crossed at the wrong time, lost in the fog. What should have been an 8-hour crossing was 17 hours. We pulled 9 of the 14 kayakers into the walrus skin boat. We had to cut some of the kayaks loose. I'll never forget watching that gorgeous three-hole Baidara disappear beneath the waves.
Oh, my gosh.
It was terrible weather at that point. And we thought the other 5 people had died. We took shelter on Big Diomede Island, where there is a small military base. And the last time anybody from Diomede had gone over to the Big Island, they had it was in 1948, and 19 people were taken captive and held for 52 days. So the Diomeders were very reluctant to land there.
Right, and the international border runs right out between these two traditional...
No, I'm going on, but the other...
No, I was just
going
to say, the international border lies right between these two, just to orient people, the border between the U.S. and Russia runs right between these two islands where they can see each other, but from 1948 until the 1990s, nobody could go back and forth. It's an amazing story.
Well, and they can't now either.
Yeah.
And these islands are 2.5 miles apart. They are, I mean, it's phenomenal how close our next-door neighbor, Russia, is to the United States. And the international dateline runs between the two. So when you're on Diomede, you're looking at tomorrow. When you're in Russia, you're looking at yesterday.
Right. So you but, finally, through this adventure, so that, go ahead.
Yeah. That led to meeting, there were Russian adventurers doing the same thing in the opposite direction. I met some of them, and that led to inviting them to try to get involved in the Yukon Quest in Nome, because I was a dog musher, and it led to being invited to bring my dog team over to Chukotka the year before the Hope Race. Some people may have heard of that. I went over in the spring of 90 and brought my 9 dogs with me and one other American, and we had an amazing journey. We traveled for 2 weeks, just took our time. We had some Russians traveling with us and some local native mushers, and we visited different villages, outposts. We were met by women with basins of seal meat and walrus meat for our dogs. And
wow. Tell us what it's like over there.
A lovely journey. What was really remarkable was when we finally crested this hill, and I saw the Diomede Islands from the other side.
Oh, yeah.
It was like looking in a mirror, and what had been half of the Bering Sea or Bering Straits became whole in that moment.
So is it just like Alaska? I mean, is it exactly like the Seward Peninsula, like tundra flat over there, or is it any different at all?
I think it's surprisingly different. When, you know, Nome is more mountainous than people realize, but we do have a flat coastal plain for 2 miles, and then we build into our mountains inland. When you land in Providencia, it is very mountainous, right down to the sea. I think that their climate is drier than ours. I think the weather system must pick up moisture as it moves across the straits and into Alaska, because you don't see a lot of willows or blueberry shrubs. It's a much drier, mountainous, spectacular country, and more of a convoluted coastline with some big inlets and islands, and a lot of still intact, very ancient native sites that are extraordinary, with whale bones and skulls and grave sites.
Wow. And really undeveloped. It sounds like even more sparsely populated perhaps than Alaska, and certainly less developed in terms of, like, nothing there in terms of services or modern technology, at least in 1990, I guess.
Well, you know, I mean, it has varied. Chukotka is actually very well supported under Soviet rule, because it was considered a hardship tour. And so they would offer professionals triple salaries, triple vacation time, which they then extended to the native people as well. And then with the collapse of the Soviet Union, all support for Chukotka disappeared literally overnight. And when I was over in 2000, I was in villages that had not had any electricity or heat for 2 years because the fuel ship just never came. However, eventually one of the big oligarchs became the governor of the region, and he put a lot of his own money and foundation money and has gone a long ways to improving life in the villages.
Roman Abramovich, right?
There are no roads between the villages. And their transportation, they don't have, we have several flights a day to each one of our villages out of Nome, whereas over there, there's no planes or airstrips. It's all done by military helicopter. So you catch a ride maybe once a week into another area. Although, people are still running dog teams, and that's a form of transportation as well as a sport. And then they have snow machines as well. But people are extremely resourceful. And, I don't want to think, I mean, they're not living, it was pretty destitute back in 2000. But now I think things have improved considerably.
I'm talking with Stu Steinecker from Nome. She is a former musher and adventurer who was fortunate enough to take advantage of that brief time period when the Russian Far East was wide open to Alaskans, and went over and did some mushing and sailing and kayaking. And you had some pretty dramatic adventures over there that weren't so great, I know. So I don't know if you want to get into the plane crash and those incidents.
Well, I'll try to do it briefly.
All right.
But yes, it was. So yes, we had done this 10-day, 2-week mushing trip up the coast, and we were met by two Russian biplanes. Very unusual to have had them come into this region, and they landed on the ice of the lagoon behind a village, and we put three dog teams in one and three dog teams in the other. And on the plane I was riding in, on takeoff, we had gotten about 100 feet up, and all of a sudden there was screaming. And we were not in seats. I was sitting on my dog sled with my dogs clipped in all around me. And even though I didn't know what they were saying, I knew it wasn't good. And I braced myself on my sled, and we stalled, and we crashed from a height of about 100 feet onto the ice.
Oh, my gosh.
And horribly, one of our teammates from Russia was killed in this crash.
Oh, my gosh.
And three of our dogs were killed in this crash. And two of mine ran away. And
you injured, Sue?
I had like 4 broken ribs and a banged up hip and a pretty impressive hematoma, I guess they call it, bruise. But fortunately, you know, at one point they thought I maybe had punctured a lung, but that fortunately was not the case. But the villagers were beside themselves. I mean, they watched us take off, they waved us into the sky, and then they watched this tragedy happen. And they, you know, kept me and another injured person in their clinic for the night. And the next day, very early, a Soviet helicopter appeared, and they wanted to get the wounded Russian, wounded American woman out of their country as fast as possible. So even though I had two missing dogs, I took all of my remaining dogs. They made me get on the plane, on the helicopter. One of the villagers got hopped on right at the last minute and put a little puppy in my lap, I think, as a way of making up for my losses. And I came back to Nome. I had friends over there that were continuing to look for the dogs, and I learned that one had taken to killing reindeer calves, and they couldn't catch him, and they ended up shooting him, which was more than understandable. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sad, but that was their mainstay. And this other little shy white dog, Vixen, just disappeared. And she'd been the last dog I had rescued from the plane, and I knew she'd been injured. So when there was no sign of her for 6 weeks or more, with people looking, I just assumed she had died in the tundra. And then all of a sudden, I get a message from a friend in Providenia that miraculously, Vixen has resurfaced in Providenia, where we had spent the first night of our trip and then continued across a, you know, trackless tundra for 2 weeks. And she had found her way back, and 2 months after the crash was still wearing her harness.
Amazing.
So they grabbed her, and then we spent 3 more weeks struggling with the authorities to release her. There had been a case of rabies in Providenia, and they didn't want to send a dog back to America that could have brought rabies from the Soviet Union. But it was a very unique time in history. When that border first opened, they were very sensitive about being viewed positively by the American press. And so as a desperate effort, I told a lie to my friend, and I said, "Do your authorities know that there are television reporters and newspaper reporters and radio reporters all here in Nome waiting for this dog to come home?" And he's like, "Oh, Susanna, you should have told me this sooner." She came home on the next flight.
And that was a white lie.
And I thought, oh my goodness, they've been feeding her very well over there. I'm pretty dense. It took about 3 days before I realized, oh my goodness, she's come home pregnant.
Oh, wow. What a story. And
so
what a great dog, huh?
My little shy Vixen, who'd been lost for 2 months and then struggled for weeks to get her home, finally came home pregnant, and about 6 weeks later gave birth to seven, well, the press dubbed the glass-nose pups.
Right.
And
amazing.
And so it was just quite a remarkable time. I mean, this didn't keep me from going back over. I hopped on some crazy sailboat and sailed to Kamchatka and got on an international skin boat expedition and just went and spent time with people there, always in the small villages, always with, you know, just local people that were so good to me. But
it makes me kind of wish this was still going on.
To bring this little dog home at that time in history was quite something.
It's so neat, yeah. And I feel like you're very fortunate to have lived through a period when this was possible. And as you mentioned earlier, it kind of shut down after that. And it's really not, at least to get to Chukotka and do the things that you did would be extremely difficult today, it sounds like.
There was that freedom that we had for 4 or 5 years is no longer there. Now, unlike everywhere else in Russia, where all you need is a visa, you need a visa for Chukotka, but you also need something called a border permit. This is because Chukotka is a closed region, even within Russia. And this border permit can take a month to 2 months to acquire, and you need to arrive with that and your visa. There's now what was a regional park has become a federal park, Beringia or Beringia Park.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people there that I don't know just what the infrastructure is for tourists. You know, I think it's best to go with someone who knows how to make these arrangements, but you can't simply, you can't go over now and just paddle your kayak up the coast and cross at the straits. It just,
you'll be arrested.
Guards,
yeah.
They're not going to allow that anymore. But there are certainly, you know, limited opportunities, and really, I mean, still, it's a tremendous region to visit, and it can be done. So,
in some ways, it sounds like an Alaska of the past, still much more, correct me if I'm wrong, but still much more as Alaska might have been before some of the development happened here.
It's a mix. You know, I think that, yeah, back in when the Soviet Union first collapsed, and people had reverted back to using seal oil lamps to heat their little apartments, which they had never expected. And now, you know, you find a mix because of the renewed infrastructure that the former, most recent governor,
Roman Abramovich
brought in. So I haven't been over for about 7 years.
Yeah.
And it's an area that's struggling. It's definitely struggling.
And if folks want to visit that kind of terrain, I mean, we have the Bering Land Bridge National Preserve on our side, and there's lots to do around Nome and on the Seward Peninsula. And I actually think we should do a show about that in the future. But if you want to go mushing, that's maybe a much easier place to go.
Well, actually, you know, yeah, I've been out here the better part of the last 30-something years, and I really think that the Nome area and the Seward Peninsula in general is one of the best-kept secrets of Alaska from Alaskans. They just think that we are all a flatland, and we are so not. We have beautiful mountains, clear running rivers, sandy beaches, rocky headlands, lagoons, and half of the year or more, we have over 300 miles of good gravel roads.
Yeah, great cycling up there, right?
And give you access to this country. Of the best hiking in Alaska is out here, because you can drive to where you are above any willows, and you just get on these rocky ridge lines and go. And yet there's nobody else out there, so it's readily accessible and hardly accessed.
And you see a lot of wildlife you're not used to seeing, like reindeer herds and caribou and muskox, and it is very, very beautiful. So that's a good tip. And
we have really, I mean,
and the bird watching is beyond belief. Yeah,
muskoxen right here in the Nome area is extraordinary. I mean, just in a drive yesterday, I probably saw 75, and they actually come right into town. I've had them in my front yard. So, yes, this is a terrific place to come for viewing wild muskoxen.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. Sue Steinecker of Nome, musher and adventurer and good salesman for visiting Nome and seeing the Seward Peninsula. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you. I've appreciated your interest.
And earlier we heard from Mark Dudley talking about the opportunities to get to the Russian Far East that exists now, and from Erica Monahan Downs about adventuring on Kamchatka. Our producer of Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. Our assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolforth. Thanks for being with us. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.